Good morning, everyone. I will call this hybrid meeting of the House Ways and Means Committee for April 21st to order. This hybrid hearing is taking place pursuant to Rule 10.01 and can also be viewed through the House webcast. Ms. Anna, please take the roll for attendance.
Chair Moran.
Present.
Vice Chair Olson.
Present.
Representative Garofalo.
Present.
Representative Albright. Representative Becker Finn.
Becker Finn present.
Representative Bernardi.
Bernardi present.
Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Representative Hassan. Representative Hertas. Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Johnson. Representative Kreshaw. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Lilly. Representative Mariani.
Mariani present.
Representative Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Miller.
Present.
Representative Nash.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Knorr.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski present.
Representative Petersburg.
Present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Representative Schultz.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Sundin.
Sundin present.
Representative Albright.
Here.
Representative Hassan.
Hassan here.
Representative Hertas. Representative Kreshaw.
Here.
And Representative Lilly. Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
So a quorum is present. Our first agenda item is approval of the minutes from our previous hearing. So we have two sets of minutes in the members' package, and they were also posted online. Vice Chair Olson, can I get a motion to approve the minutes for April 19, 2022?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions or corrections to those minutes? If not, all in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Vice Chair Olson, can I get a motion to approve the minutes for April the 20th, 2022?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions or corrections to those minutes? If not, all in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. So members, we have two bills on the agenda today. They will be merged into House File 4300 for one omnibus bill on education. And we have until 10:45 to complete the agenda. If we don't get done, we'll recess and we'll come back at 1 to finish. But before we start, I would like to give Representative Miller a moment to share some information.
Madam Chair, thank you. So members, if we get our work done on time, there's a reward at the end. Today is Steak on a Stick Day with the Minnesota Cattlemen's out in front of the Minnesota Capitol. So the wind is blowing from the south, so I think while we're in session we're gonna be smelling it. But please come out and join them. It's a beautiful day. If you were here, it's like 3 years ago now. It's tenderloin. This is like the best of the best. Be sure enjoy it.
What time is that?
11 to 1. So session better be short too.
There we go.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, so let's get started. First up is House File 4735, which is the Supplemental Early Childhood Omnibus Bill. This is a bill that spans two committees, Education and Human Services. Even though we'll be splitting House File 4725 between the two omnibus bills, Chair Pinto, I understand you'd like to present the entire package today. So hopefully we want to do this again when Health and Human Services come here. I think that's how we did it last year. So let's move the bill and begin. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I do move House File 4735 to bring it before the committee. And I'll proceed with your permission.
Okay. Would you also like to move the H4735A6 amendment?
Madam Chair, I think what I may do, if it's okay, is to describe the bill first for a bit, and then we can get to the amendment. And that might make more sense.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, so I'm really delighted to be with you today to present the supplemental budget proposal from the Early Childhood Committee. As the Chair said, our proposal does span, as it has for the last few years, both the E-12 committee's jurisdiction and or that area and HHS as well. So we'll be moving the education portion later today and the HHS portion in a week, but discussing the whole proposal today. Adding to the confusion is that there's a portion of the E-12 budget proposal that actually came out of our committee as well relating to pre-K. And so my hope is that we're able to discuss that as well as part of this. Members, child care and early learning was in deep crisis even before the pandemic. And then the pandemic, of course, made the situation even worse. This is a sector where families are paying a huge portion of their income for care, where providers are living off poverty wages, and where young kids are not receiving the great start that they deserve. It's probably important to note at the very start that the issue is that the economics simply don't add up. And so the challenge is that we want to make sure that we are providing the support that young kids need and that families need. And a reminder that this is foundational to our economy and to our society. This is about our workforce now in the form of parents working and employers being able to grow and communities to thrive, and it's also our workforce of the future to give kids the great start that they deserve and to avoid the opportunity gaps that we see in school and beyond, and that I will note that start well before school, and so for closing opportunity gaps, this is the place to do it. During the pandemic, members, we saw that public investment worked. We were one of the very first states, maybe even the first state, to provide state support to our child care providers, and we had a much more stabilized sector than in other states. If you ask any parent of young kids, any kindergarten teacher, any employer, that child care is, for those employers, child care is one of the top workforce development concerns for companies and communities throughout the state. So all that is lead up to say that the bill in front of you today goes right at those needs that we that I described. So first, we invest in the kids and families with the very biggest payoff. The Child Care Assistance Program helps low-income families, and what we do is we increase rates to the federal guideline for equal access. That's the 75th percentile. This is the rate at which we've determined that families, and the federal government has determined that families can actually afford to afford care and to have their kids taken care of and have them be able to work so they can pay for rent and for food, et cetera. We expand eligibility for the program to include foster parents and guardians, which is, of course, really important because those are kids we're especially concerned about, and we reduce waiting lists. We also provide early learning scholarships to 20,000 young kids birth to three, infants and toddlers, from low-income and vulnerable families. These, again, are the kids that we're most concerned about. And then as these kids turn four, we ensure that they have access to a voluntary pre-K that can be at their public school, at their Head Start, their child care provider. It's mixed delivery. It's voluntary. We want to make sure that those kids have that connection to school. And we'll be able to talk more about that in detail, I'm sure. So we focus on those kids and families with the very biggest payoff, but we also provide great support for those providing this critical service. There's funding for training, for workforce development, and I guess I'll point you to, in a way, the spreadsheet that we have has a really nice list of the programs and the approaches that we take, wanting to make sure that we are providing, there's a one-stop child care assistance network that you'll see that was called for by our critical family child care providers. We have something called the Brain Builders program to help those who are working with infants and toddlers to maintain their connection, because we know that that ongoing relationship is so critical for brain development for the youngest kids. And perhaps most important relates to the stabilization grants that I mentioned at the very very start of the pandemic. Our state was the first to start these grants. They've been going out monthly to providers ever since, with state funding, with federal funding. Members, we may not have noticed this issue so much recently because, in fact, our sector has not collapsed because of that support that's been provided. Those stabilization grants are tailing off, and what our budget does is to make sure that those grants stay in place through the remainder of the biennium and are going at a lower level from there on out. Members, this is a public good. I cannot think of a more powerful public good than getting our young kids off to a great start and having it be at the same time that we're supporting their families to work, et cetera. And what we do is that we have our public public support should in fact reflect that public good. Madam Chair, I may at this point ask to have to advance the amendment then, with your permission.
Yes, please.
Okay. So, members, the A6 contains largely technical changes. There's one particular item that I'm going to highlight. Largely technical changes. I'll note that I mentioned that Brain Builders program. We make a shift in that program. It looks like it's a brand new program. It's actually not. What we're doing is actually converting into a pilot program. It's essentially a lesser approach than we were taking in the original bill. We want to make sure that we have time to make sure that we're clear on that. A few other things as well, but the big thing I wanted to note is there's a proposal for IT infrastructure to address concerns that have been identified for several years now regarding how the different data systems are talking to one another and how different data sharing works across the different agencies. And so we do make some changes to that, in particular in response to a fiscal note that was just recently received, to make sure the different agencies have the cost that they need covered for that. And I'm certainly happy to talk more about that. But members, I would ask that you pass the A6 and we can talk further about the bill.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Are there any questions on the amendment? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this would be a question for our fiscal staff. So we have two spreadsheets in our packet. One of them is labeled the A5 amendment as referred to Ways and Means. The other one is the A6 amendment that Representative Pinto is offering. I just want to make sure that's the only difference between – I didn't review the spreadsheet yet. Is that the only difference is the Pinto amendment between these two spreadsheets?
Okay, Ms. Adrian.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo and members, I believe that is correct. Ms. Beckel is on the meeting. I don't know if she wants to make any additional mention of it, but I do. That is my understanding that that's the only difference.
Thank you. That's good. Thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions to Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering if the bill's author could just address lines 6.13 through 6.17 and explain to the committee the data sharing components of that paragraph. Of the amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott, so much for highlighting that. So let me think. If I may need to take just a second to step back, if folks don't mind. There have been concerns about governance in early childhood for a number of years, recognizing that we have a whole bunch of different programs across multiple agencies and a lot of complexity. We, as a legislature, directed the administration last year to put together a governance report to say, how's this working? How can it work better? And one of the findings from that report was saying that there's a real challenge with data sharing and with different programs working together. I mean, literally, that you know, subsidies for early care and learning are contained in Department of Human Services in the form of CCAP, in MDE in the form of early learning scholarships, school readiness plus, voluntary pre-K Pathway 1 scholarships, Pathway 2 scholarships. It's a lot going on. And they said that there's a need for that to be looked at. And there was a 2018 Office of Legislative Auditor report saying as well a real challenge with this. These lines that you pointed out, Representative Scott, come out of a bill that I had that moved through the Early Childhood Committee, was heard in State Gov Finance, and passed back to Early Childhood. That would address both concerns about the technology and then the different computer systems being able to talk to each other. They're super old, as I gather, and a big mess. But then also looking at any sort of administrative rules or challenges that maybe need to be changed. Of course, anything that would need to happen legislatively, they'd need to come back to us for us to report on. But this comes out of that, and then there's a series. I think you've pointed out these lines, but they're connected other lines throughout the amendment as well of funding to get that done. So that at least maybe gives you a big picture. You may have a more detailed question, but hopefully gives you the context.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so is this was this sort of an education policy?
Madam Chair. It was not an education policy because this is within the early childhood jurisdiction. Okay. So, yeah, no.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And did this go to judiciary and civil law since this deals with data sharing?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We checked with Chair Becker Finn, as I recall, and there was not a need for it to be seen. It's not proposing any changes to any of our statutes. What it really is having the different agencies look at how they interact with one another. This is all data that's already held by the agencies, and by state agencies, and looking at how they communicate with one another.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. So this is more on a tech level, just sort of interconnecting the databases, if you will, or is and if you know, what information is being shared?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wonder, maybe staff, Ms. Mock, can just help remind me, because I'm just struggling with it, about where in the bill, because we can direct Representative Scott to the language this is referred, the underlying language in the bill. I think that'd be helpful for you, Representative Scott.
Mr. Mock.
Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
So the language this is referring to is in House File 4735, the first engrossment, in Article 3, Section 4. And what the direction to the Commissioner of Management and Budget is to identify any state or federal statutes or administrative rules and practices that prevent or complicate data sharing among early childhood programs.
Representative.
Madam Chair, thank you. Could the testifier please give us a page and line number in the underlying bill, because Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it starts on page 27, line 28.
There we go.
Madam Chair, if somebody else has questions, you can go to them while I look at this in more detail. That's okay.
While we're waiting for you to read up on that, Ms. Adrian has a clarifying statement in regards to Representative Garofalo's question about the spreadsheet.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I haven't had nearly enough coffee yet this morning, so I just wanted to correct what I was saying. So for the early childhood spreadsheet, there should only be one document, and that one it was amended by the A6. And when we get to the education portion, there are two tracking documents also amended by the A6. And so the difference there, the distinction is one reflects the one of the amendments and one was as referred to Ways and Means. But for this bill that we're talking about, there should only be one spreadsheet.
Yep. Thanks.
Sorry about that.
Okay. No,
that's
what you said.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Representative Pinto and whoever was on the testifier online. So are the parents, do they sign off on this data sharing? Is this data sharing that's already done, if the author knows?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, yes, they, I definitely know the second half of your question, which is this is data sharing that is already done, that it's not, this is simply talking about data that's already in the hands of these programs. I would assume, I guess I should probably stop there because I'm not an expert at how, all I know is that there's a whole lot of different programs and it's all very fragmented space, but this is not talking about expanding data collection in any way. This is information that's already in the hands of the agencies, that's correct.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just concerned that if they're sharing the data from one, like, quote-unquote agency to another agency, that the parents have signed off on that. So, I guess, Madam Chair, maybe I'll just talk with the bill's author offline to just have some assurances on that. Just want to make sure that the parents are given that ability. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. Are there any other questions on the amendment? So seeing no further questions, the A6 amendment is before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay, Chair Pinto, you want to continue with your presentation as amended?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And I want to make sure before I forget, just to thank Representative Scott. Yeah, I'd be really happy to talk with her and take advantage of her expertise. So be happy to do that. And then I think there's plenty of good stuff in here, I'm thinking what I'll do is turn to questions, yeah. Madam Chair.
And there's no other amendment we're pre-filed, so we're going to open up for questions on the bill as amended. Any questions? Representative Creesha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Pinto, for your bill. So just a couple of questions as I go through this. Can I do this, Madam Chair? Can I have staff explain the changes to the Pathway 1, Pathway 2 funding mechanisms and
yes,
what those dollar changes would be?
Yeah, can staff
do that? Maybe Ms. Mock, probably.
Ms. Mock, is that a question for you also?
Madam Chair, I think that would be a better question for Ms. Speckler.
Ms. Speckler? Ms. Beckler.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm just trying to hear. It's a little bit difficult. Please,
thank
testify.
You,
can you speak to this?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Solvay Beckel, House Fiscal. Yes, so part of the VPK proposal is to reallocate funding that is currently going towards Pathway 2, the Pathway 2 program, toward the mixed delivery voluntary pre-K programs. And so the funding in this bill, if you'll allow me one moment, because the voluntary pre-kindergarten program was related to so many formula changes, the VPK proposal was carried in its entirety in the education, the K-12 omnibus. But to answer your question, there will be roughly $18 million in fiscal year 23 that is to be reallocated under this program from Pathway 2 to the mixed delivery voluntary pre-kindergarten program. I can talk more to that now if you'd like, or when we discuss the education office.
Representative Creesha, were you able to hear and understand the difference in the pathways?
Madam Chair, we're in the Capitol. I'll just make up the narrative as I need to be. thank you. I did hear.
Proceed.
So thank you. So first question on that. If I heard that correct, Chair Pinto, one of the net effects will be $18 million will be moved out of Pathway 2 into the mixed delivery. Is that correct?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Creesha, yeah, that's what I heard as well. And I maybe just to add that my understanding is that the plan, I believe what what I intended to do anyway, is to basically no longer have Pathway 2 scholarships, which for those not as familiar, they're the ones that go to a provider as opposed to going necessarily with an individual family. And the Pathway 1 scholarships then would be aimed at infants and toddlers. And instead for pre-K, it'd be that mixed delivery system and no more Pathway 2 scholarships.
Representative Creesha.
Thank you. And so, Mr. Chair, that begs the question. We're now moving and we're shifting the dollars to the mixed delivery and the 0 to 3. What happens to the 4 through 5 year olds?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Creesha. Well, the $18 million actually doesn't get shifted to infants and toddlers. It gets shifted to the four-year-old VPK program. So for kids who are 4 and older, they are part of the mixed delivery VPK program. So they'll go to their local licensed child care provider or Head Start or public school. It's the Pathway 1 scholarships, then the name of the infants and toddlers. I hope that's answering what you're asking.
Representative Creesha.
Madam Chair. So if I'm what you're telling me is there's so we're actually covering all of our bases, even though we're shifting to the 0 and 3, we have enough now that won't create a donut hole of students that won't be, or children that won't be serviced by any of these models. Is that correct?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Creesha, correct, no donut hole. More kids need care, but as far as those lowest income kids, yep, they're covered from birth on up through these different methods, correct.
Representative Creesha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do you have the success metrics on Pathway 1 versus Pathway 2 and why we would do those shifts?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that I do with me. I guess I've thought of you, Representative Carisha, as being somebody who's a real fan of Pathway One scholarships, which makes me think you'd be very happy with the major increase in Pathway One scholarships here. I don't have those metrics with me. I just know that when you invest in young kids in all these different ways, huge payoffs.
Representative Carisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my happiness is not on the stand today. It's the bill. And so thank you, Chair Pinto. I just want to make sure I understand it and make sure that we're covering it across the board. So when we look at that, and yes, you've left the Pathway One largely untouched, of course, which goes right to the families and the kids. And I just want to make sure that I think there's a tendency from some to go to a mixed delivery or more institutional model, which would move us away from some of the things that have worked, especially in some of the neighborhoods and communities across the country that can use the choice. So my next question is, we make a large push in here for CCAP. Do we have any metrics? Do we have any outcomes on how CCAP performs versus Pathway One funding? And was that a part of the consideration?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'll say, Representative Carisha, is different programs for different needs, and we know that in Greater Minnesota, especially, that CCAP plays just a critical role in keeping those communities going, keeping employers being able to have workers, et cetera. I don't have data with me specifically about one program versus another, but I do know that there's again just a tremendous payoff in each one of these approaches.
Really quick, I just want to remind members there's a little buzzing of something that's happening to remove your phones away from the microphone. Thank you. Remove your phones from the microphones. Did you hear it? Okay. Representative Carisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I understand your comments, Chair Pinto. I would submit, though, that what we're doing here is we're putting the needs of an institution ahead of the needs of the kids. And what I heard in your comments, I don't want to take them in a different direction that you intended, but what I'm sensing is we're putting dollars in to keep programs running versus putting dollars into what can be the most effective for our kids. I don't think that just simply enrollment is a metric. In fact, I think the metrics we should be looking at is kindergarten readiness and those outcomes come to the achievement gaps later and learning losses that can happen. I respect where you're going with here. I disagree that by simply putting more dollars into a program to expand the net without considerations of how that's going to drive outcomes isn't a good way to put together a bill. Can MDE repurpose any of the funds that we put together at their discretion?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Carisha, I don't believe so, but that may be something that we should have staff, if there's anybody who can. I mean, that certainly my intent is that, and I think anybody that I've dealt with in the administration otherwise knows that I want every single dollar to go to young kids and their care and learning. But if there's, there may be assistance that staff can provide if there's something that I'm missing there.
And Representative Chair Pinto, maybe you can get closer to your mic.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Yeah. I've been backing off, I think, because of the echo I've been hearing, but yeah. I'll get closer myself.
Yeah. Carisha, do you need more information?
Well, I'd like an answer.
Pardon me?
I'd like an answer.
Is there a staff? Is there someone that can respond? We have MDE on a call. Can you please respond to the question?
Chair?
Introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, Solveig Bethel, House Fiscal. Can you hear me any better?
It's really a little difficult.
No. She had to get closer.
Okay, I will try to speak
better.
Loudly.
Yes.
That's better?
That's better.
Okay. I'm not entirely sure I'm understanding the question fully, but I did want to add that in the VPK program, which again is fully in the education omnibus, there are allowances for MDE in terms of administration. Roughly $2.4 million per year is allocated to administration for distributing the mixed delivery funds, so to Head Start and to family and licensed centers. And then there's an additional roughly $2.5 million that MDE is allowed to use for administering the entire program. I see Mr. Uni from the department is here, so he can correct me if that's incorrect.
Madam Chair, maybe I can clarify my question.
Okay, Representative Creason.
Let me ask it this way, and Chair Pinto, perhaps you can point me. What in this bill prevents MDE from reallocating any of the money from one program or a grant to something that someone chooses they'd like to do differently?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Creason, I guess, so I should note, it is my intention, absolutely, the funds go to the areas that we direct them to go, and it'd be my expectation, I mean, when the legislature says you shall spend X on Y, that X is spent on Y and is not spent on Z, or going back around A, B, or C. So it's written that way, that's absolutely the intention. So I think if the department were to do such a thing, unless you think I'm misreading something, and please point it out, or anybody else who's listening, but my thinking is if we tell them to spend X on Y and they spend it on Z, that's a problem. I mean, they have now not done what we told them to do, and I think we all, I mean, I'll be the first one to go after them hard. I don't know what else to say.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not really, I just wanted to make sure that was in there. I'm looking for the safeguard.
Right.
I think that your passion and your experience and what you've done in early childhood begs that you're looking for the best results. And I just want to make sure that those intentions, if this is passed, are carried through and not changed because somebody changes their mind at the executive level, which we've seen in the past.
Me neither.
In other areas. Madam Chair?
Representative Creason.
So just a couple more questions. Chair Pinto, in Article 5, you make the change of the distribution of the appropriation where in lines 2.297 and 298, that migrant and Indian reservation programs were initially allocated, and we now put a 10.72% appropriation. Why the change? What wasn't happening that needed to happen?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I may need to, that was a proposal originally from the administration, and I may need to ask either Ms. Mock to help remind me about that. I think she's done this a couple times now, just keeps slipping out of my head, or potentially MD, but maybe we'll see what Ms. Mock thinks of House Research, Madam Chair.
Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will actually ask Mr. Uni from MDE to take that question.
Okay. Mr. Uni?
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Ados Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. And this has been a proposal that we've come with for several years now to maintain the stability of funding for tribal Head Start programs. This has been something that's been discussed amongst Head Start programs in general as a proposal that they can all get behind, and this will help maintain the stability of programs that serve some of our most underserved youngest learners in the state.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Creason.
Thank you. And hello, Mr. Uni. How are you? So this is a proposal that's come a couple of times. Why 10.72%? What is the magic number about that with stability versus how we were doing this before? Can you just walk me through the gap?
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Creason, at this point, I think I have my Assistant Commissioner Bobby Burnham on, who's got a deeper history with this proposal, so I'll defer to her.
Ms. Barney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is a really good question, Representative Creason. So what typically happens from year to year, because our state, these are Head Start tribal programs, so because the state Head Start funds are based off the federal formula, and the federal formula fluctuates from year to year. We were finding that the tribal Head Start programs fluctuated greatly from year to year, with over the last couple years, mainly decreases in funding. So this 10.72% really is an effort to hold them harmless and I believe the 2018 funding allocation, and to give them a predetermined amount every year that they can depend on to do their programming and services to children. So this is really around taking away the fluctuation with those tribal Head Start programs due to the federal funding formula. I think over the past years, we've had at least one or two new federally funded Head Start programs, which then we have to go through a different formula for the state. So when there's more programs, other programs get less money because that $25 million in state funds is a set amount. So it's really balancing all the numbers and ensuring that those tribal Head Start programs have a predetermined amount to provide their services.
Representative Creason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so, and I appreciate that. I understand the goal of having stabilized funding. So, and I'm sorry, the testifier, I caught her first name. Was it Berman? Ms. Berman, was that? I don't want to pronounce that correctly.
Yes.
So, Ms. Berman, just so I understand, so what you're saying is when there's funding and then we at the legislature or the executive branch grows more problem or programs, there's less money, so therefore the dollar amounts go down. Is that correct?
Ms. Berman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is correct. So because the state Head Start programs are federally administered, we at the state have that $25 million allocation, which is great. Very many states do that. So we allocate that state money in the same manner that the feds allocate their federal allocations. So it allows for too much fluctuation for those tribal Head Start programs.
Representative Creason.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Berman. So thank you, Chair Pinto, for putting this in, and I think we've put another finger in the dike, but we haven't actually fixed the water level, which is we're creating more programs, which are therefore lowering the water for everybody. And I understand what we're doing now, which is we are truly holding them harmless. We're taking one segment of the Head Start and we're segmenting them off so that they cannot be affected when legislators or the legislature pass or creates more programs. So I see why you're doing that, and I see why there's multiple proposals. I also see that every organization out there would like to have a carve out like this. So, but I don't dispute where you're going, the effects of it. I dispute the fact that it's us that are creating the problems by creating more programs. The last one that I have is, I'm curious, Chair Pinto, we put $125,000 in the ombudsperson for the family child care providers. Ombudsperson positions, we see them pop up all the time. What I really want to know, and maybe you can help me through this, it seems to be a nice bone that we throw at people, but what is it really going to solve? What will that $125,000, what metric or what outcome will we actually see that will be improved by having that position?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Creason, for the question. So that position, Family Child Care Ombudsperson, came out as recommendation and request from the Family Child Care Task Force that we appointed as a legislature, and I'm trying to think of the exact time, it would have been a couple years ago now, and they had a series of recommendations. I should note that not only did our budget last year include a whole bunch of recommendations, this budget includes other ones as well. You'll notice shared services to allow family child care providers to efficiently share kind of back-end services to help save some money that way, and the one-stop shop I think I mentioned earlier, but this was another one of those, and to make sure that those that request was met. As I gather, they wanted to have a person who was going to be in the position of bringing concerns forward and being in contact with family child care providers around the state, who are, of course, in a really, really challenging position in what is a very challenging sector, as I said before.
Representative Creason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Pinto, thank you for that. And I understand the spirit of which this was created. I'm just, my concern is what we've created is one more person to take notes and admire the problems that we already have. I mean, when we look at Health and Human Services, and there's some, you know, I've worked with many people in the Health and Human Services, whether it's child protection, family child care providers, early childhood, and they're all seeing the problems. They're gathering this. We've had, we travel around the state. I just, you know, it's $125,000, but again, we just heard that the more we expand things, the less money is available for the programs. We have to create carve-outs. And my contention here is, okay, it's a nice to have, but isn't this just the 75th redundancy and the 75th amplification of what we've already heard about the challenges in family child care providers? So, but it's your bill. And I understand, you know, that why you might put that in. So thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you. I wish you the best of luck with the bill going forward. No further questions.
Thank you, Representative Creshaw. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to see you, Representative Pinto. I just have a few quick questions about CCAP. And you and I serve on public safety, and we've worked on some really tough things in the past. And my question is, it looks like you're putting an awful lot of money, it looks like $220 million and some change into CCAP, which, I mean, I'm sure it's needed, but my concern is when the OLA did a deep dive into the CCAP program, we found a great deal of fraud, waste, and abuse, heavy on the fraud. And I'm wondering what's been done since the OLA report to the CCAP program to tighten that up, and if you could speak to that. And the other thing was wondering is, as I'm looking through, it looks like we're going from, for infants and toddlers, from the 40th percentile all the way up to 75th percentile, and for preschoolers, school aged, it's closer to the 30th percentile up to the 75th percentile, which is obviously equates to the $220 million that we're adding into the program. So can you just further explain the thought process behind that huge move? It's almost a doubling. And then what kind of provisions either are in this bill or have been done to deal with waste, fraud, and abuse?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much, Representative O'Neill, for bringing that up. So one challenge is that nobody else on Ways and Means serves on early childhood, so you wouldn't have had the chance to hear about all this. So in 2019, we enacted as a legislature a series of significant reforms in the program, and I'm looking. I can maybe get to you after, as Representative O'Neill, kind of a summary sheet from past years. But enhancing record keeping requirements for CCAP providers, clarifying various requirements, having a uniform method for calculating attendance record overpayments. I got a long list, and in particular, directing that there be, and I think part of this was on a DHS initiative as well, that there be a continuous improvement group that went in and just went stem to stern on the whole program. So our very first hearing in 2020 then in the Early Childhood Committee was a report on this. This is a couple years ago now. And I would urge folks to watch the hearing, because as a member, a two-way member from DFL, GOP, et cetera, I think it's fair to say folks were extremely impressed. And this was a couple of years ago. So to answer your question, what has been done? A massive amount has been done. And the program is in a very different place. I would challenge some of the points about, you know, where things were even in the past. But regardless, we had massive changes. Now, you know, if everybody did everything perfectly all the time, then as a prosecutor, I'd be out of a job. Right, so we know that there's things are not perfect, but we want to make sure is that we are preventing to the extent we can, and then to the extent folks are doing things that are wrong, that we're holding them accountable. And there's a lot in place on that, so feeling very good about that piece of things. And then regarding the rates, and I should have said this before, Minnesota is in, I think, like the bottom five in the country in terms of the rates for our child care assistance program. It's got a different name in different states. You know, some of the states that are 75th percentile include both of the Dakotas, Kansas, Kentucky, Utah, Alabama, Arkansas, 75th percentile. Minnesota's in the bottom five. And so no wonder we're having huge challenges throughout our state. We should feel very good about the idea that our state should be at the level of those other states and a level where people will actually be able to pay for care so they can work, which is they're trying to do, so they can pay the rent and pay for diapers for their kids. Thanks.
Yes, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I appreciate that, and I think the proof's in the pudding, so we'll have to, you know, hopefully there's been some, there is ongoing follow-up to make sure that everything is as we hope it is, as you had said. And I know that you see the underbelly, so to speak, of society as a prosecutor in your daily work. It's interesting. So if the 75th percentile, that brings us to where nationally?
Chair Pinto.
Then we'll be at the standard for making sure that families have that costs are appropriately covered. So that's I guess notes that I have say that these it's 17 states where all their rates are the 75th percentile. Another five states have some of their rates to the 75th percentile. In our state, has a difference between preschoolers versus the younger kids. The notes I have say 75th and higher, so I suppose maybe there are states that are higher than 75th. But 75th is the standard. I would expect that that's where we want to get to.
Mm-hmm. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I'd like to work with you a little bit more. I know I have this vague recollection. I think it might have been you bringing me the bill, and we were discussing about some of the fraud, waste, and abuse, and trying to tightening up. And I don't know. It was one of those hallway conversations I think we may have had. So I know that there was a movement in that direction. It'd be really interesting to see if the OLA will circle back and reevaluate the CCAP program, because I can tell you Minnesotans are incredibly concerned about the waste, fraud, and abuse. And nobody really knows the number because it was really too difficult to even calculate according to the OLA, but it was large. It wasn't a couple million. So I think Minnesotans are incredibly concerned about the CCAP program. If we're going to literally double and put $220 million more into it, that it's safe and secure and the money goes to where it's been intended. So I just want to make sure that we get that on the record. And again, I really hope the proof's in the pudding that we've tightened up those massive holes that were there in the past.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just note, Representative O'Neill, so we have had a hearing every year that I've been chair. We've had a hearing with a report on the follow-up from this towards the beginning of each session. So we did again this year. You know, that OLA report was now 4 years ago. And again, a lot has changed in part because of the work that we've all done. So, and it's ongoing, of course, as well. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, seeing no further discussion, Chair Pinto, do you have any closing comments?
I do, Madam Chair, just briefly. First, I wanted not to forget to thank not only the staff, and you've gotten to hear some of them, especially Ms. Mock and Ms. Becko, and Mr. Berg, we didn't hear from today, but it's been incredible. But also Lee Franson, who is not on Ways and Means, but has been a very good partner to me in this work, and so I've been grateful to her for the partnership, and to our members on the committee as well. I did want to highlight something, members, that I had not said at the beginning, but feels important to note. Representative Creech had asked some questions about the pre-K program, and Terry Dabney will be coming up. But I wanted us just to recognize that it really is, although it's mixed delivery, there's a couple different places that kids can go. It is a comprehensive program, a comprehensive approach to say that whether a kid is in their licensed child care provider or their public school or at their Head Start, that we have a series of standards and measurement of progress and quality in terms of teaching and a connection with schools. That's something that I had not highlighted earlier and feels really well worth connecting and highlighting. That this is, we're really trying to make sure the kids at birth all the way up get off to a great start. I'm so grateful for the conversation, and I know it'll continue. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Well, I just want to thank you, Chair Pinto, and your committee for your excellent work on behalf of our earliest learner. We've come a long way from 2019, 2018, when we first heard of the abuse that was happening, especially around the CCAP. You put a lot of protections in place to make sure that we are doing our due diligence as a state to make sure that our early learners are getting off to a great start, that they are entering kindergarten ready and prepared, and that we are creating a path of success by the time they're in third grade, because that's the indicator of what will happen to our youngest learners and our students. So I always want to say thank you for that work. What an awesome job. And with that, I would temporarily lay over House File 4735 as amended. Thank you. So the next bill is House File 4300, which is the K-12 education funding bill. Welcome to the committee, Chair Dabney.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'd remind the committee that this bill is standing between them and steak.
That's right. Vice Chair Olson, would you like to move House File 4300 to be recommended for placement on the General Register?
So moved, Madam Chair.
So with that, Chair Dabney, please explain your, there's an amendment to your bill?
So, Madam Chair, I do have the A6 amendment, and then I would appreciate some guidance on how you wish to handle moving the early childhood portions of Chair Pinto's bill to this bill, as I understand is the intent.
So, Vice Chair Olson, would you like to offer that amendment?
Yeah, I'll move the A6 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Olson, for that. The A6 makes some technical corrections to appropriations numbers, as well as several substantive changes. It increases the percentage of the special education cross-subsidy that will be paid with by state aid from 55% to 55.895% in fiscal year 23 and 56.9405% in fiscal year 24 and later, and increases the appropriation in career and technical education aid to match the bill language, fully funding CTE-related transportation expenses. The cost of the CTE aid will now be $3.2 million a year, beginning in fiscal year 24. The bill previously overestimated the cost of its provision to buy down special education cross-subsidy, so all increased funding in this amendment still fits within the target. The A6 also replaces a provision allowing online learning providers to offer asynchronous courses, with one clarifying that independent study credit recovery programs in state-approved alternative programs may use asynchronous learning if they have done so at least the last 3 years. Madam Chair, that's the A6 amendment.
All right. Are there any questions on the amendments? Seeing none, the A6 amendment is before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So, Chair Dabney, please continue with your presentation.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, House File 4300 is amended, utilizes resources the state has, and uses them to meet our responsibilities as a legislature to students of today and the Minnesota of tomorrow. House File 4300 starts with paying our bills, stepping up to the responsibilities that we as a legislature have been avoiding and where we have fallen short. $422 million in helping school districts with the special education deficit we have left them with, growing into the tails, that helps school districts cover the costs of providing mandated services where we have fallen short in the past. It goes on to eliminate the English language learner cross subsidy by 2026, starting with an investment of $76 million in fiscal year 23 and growing into the tails. It supports student well-being and mental health by establishing a dedicated funding stream that will create 1,100 student support personnel positions across the state, school counselors, social workers, psychologists, nurses, and chemical dependency staff. With the provisions in Chair Pinto's bill, it expands access to voluntary pre-kindergarten to 23,000 more four-year-olds through a mixed delivery model that the committee just heard and reviewed. It assists students, families, and schools coming out of 3 academic years of disrupted learning with support around enrollment for schools, after-school and summer programs for youth, and full-service community schools model to better support entire school communities. It assures families whose child attend a school with higher levels of poverty that meals will be available for their children while reducing those schools' administrative burden of providing those meals. And lastly, Madam Chair, it continues our commitment to diversifying the teacher corps and offering opportunities for education support personnel who wish to become licensed school staff, offering them pathways to those careers. Madam Chair, with that, I stand available for questions. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Chair Dabney. So there are no other pre-filed amendments. So House File 4300, as amended, is before us. Are there any questions of Chair Dabney? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Dabney. I can't help but notice, because we all pull up the runs, you know, and can you just explain what happened here? I'm looking at the top line, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and the per household total increase per pupil is $1,202, so $1,202. And I just flipped to my district, you know, because that's what we all do when we get these runs. And, for example, the place that I live, Monticello, is mm-hmm. half that, $654. Mm-hmm. So just a little bit under half. And as I look through the runs, there are some that do much worse, you know, in the 200s compared to 1,201 for Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I'm just curious, how does that happen? I mean, I know we have the worst funding, well, okay, I won't say worst, the most complicated funding formula in the entire United States in our education funding formula, and there's probably four people in the entire state that actually understand the craziness of our funding formula, because we use all these different categoricals, and we have our base, but we use all the, so can you just explain in layman's terms, how does this happen that Minneapolis and St. Paul get $1,201 per pupil? And, for example, my district gets about half.
Chair Daphne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative O'Neill, usually it's thought that there's only three people in the state who understand the K-12 system. You rounded up to four.
I was hoping you would.
I'm not sure that I'm one of them, but I've got friends who are available who can help. We're paying our bills here. What we know is how much it costs to provide special education services for students in districts and across Minnesota. What we know is how much it costs to provide English language learner services to students across Minnesota. What we know is we're not paying those bills. We also know it costs a different amount in different districts based on who those students are and how they provide those services. So different districts across the state would receive different amounts of funding because we are simply reimbursing them the costs that they're incurring.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Danby, Chair Dabney. And that would make sense to me, except for the fact that I have Monticello. So Monticello, mm-hmm. actually, as you know, as we've tried to work through mm-hmm. their chaos mm-hmm. of an error that happened at MDE, mm-hmm. and then they tried to claw it back, and they never did get that money back. But through that process, you and I both know that Monticello is a co-op they for special ed, so they have more than the average school district of special ed kids because they literally are a co-op and they bring them in. And that would make sense to me, except for Monticello's number is $658, which is only $4 more than my Maple Lake school. So I still don't understand how, with your explanation in that case, that the numbers still don't work for me, because even Monticello, who are literally the co-op for special education in my area, are still a little bit more than half of the Minneapolis and St. Paul School District.
Chair Daphne.
Madam Chair, I may ask Mr. Strom, who's available online, to talk through the modeling and the reimbursement, and he may be able to shed some light here for Representative O'Neill and the committee.
Mr. Strom, please introduce yourself and proceed in response to Representative O'Neill's question.
Madam Chair, Representative Daphne and O'Neill, Tim Strom from House Research. The question of special education funding and where the cross subsidy comes from a couple of different places. One of those places, as Representative O'Neill mentioned, is the bill backs that go from the co-ops and from the joint service organizations, such as what happens in Monticello, to the resident districts. And another big portion of that comes from the intermediate school districts and charter schools that bill their special education costs back to the resident districts as well. So one piece of data that significantly affects Minneapolis and St. Paul much more than all of the rest of the districts in the state is the amount of charter school bill back for special education costs. And when we look at this number, it's referred to as the tuition billing number, and I'd be happy to share with the committee a file that breaks out each of these categories. But you'll see that because of the number of students in Minneapolis and St. Paul who are resident to those districts that attend charter schools, that the tuition billing to those districts, which is in the unreimbursed costs, is quite a bit higher. So that's the primary difference between why some school districts have very high special education costs and relatively modest special education costs. There are issues related to workforce. The formula is a reimbursement formula, and so the level of services and the salary of the providers of those services matter. But in general, when one looks at special education data, the biggest difference in terms of unreimbursed costs is the amount of tuition that's billed back to the resident.
Madam Chair?
It's your deputy.
May I ask Mr. Strom a clarifying question?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, I'm looking at Representative O'Neill's Monticello district because that has been one that she referenced some issues a few years ago. I continue to hear from time to time from parents in that district and staff about their challenges around special education funding. But Mr. Strom, am I to understand that because they operate as a co-op and are taking in students from surrounding districts and providing them those services, the Monticello public schools are able to bill back to the resident districts of those students the cost of providing those services?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, I think the Monticello situation is a little further complicated. The method that was used was the school districts formerly were in a type of cooperative arrangement where the Monticello school district was the fiscal host. Mm-hmm. And they switched to a different organizational structure, largely at the suggestion of the Department of Education that the fiscal host model wouldn't work as well as some other models. The year of the shift made all of the difference. It was the year of transition in 2016 of the special education formula. And the result was the base that got set for the groups of districts, including the Monticello School District, was quite a bit lower for the starting place. And so there was a big one-time funding gap that continues each year because of that lower base that was established. In answer to your question then, Representative Daphne, the special education services that are provided through the new cooperative structure are billed back to the resident school districts. I'll see if I can find some details in the next few minutes that I can share with you and Representative O'Neill about the reasons why Monticello's gap may appear more average than not. But I think a large part of their problem was really related to this one-time problematic choice of the start year for them for purposes of regular special education.
So, Madam Chair, I think in English, the simpler understanding is the students that Monticello takes in from other districts and provides services, the cost of those services is covered by a combination of state aid and resident district tuition payments. And so the special ed deficit that we are attempting to take on aggressively for Monticello and every other district in the state that Representative O'Neill sees here is the deficit based on the state's lack of sufficient funding for special education services for Monticello resident students. How'd I do, Representative O'Neill?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Dabney. Yeah, you're close. I mean, Monticello is a unique situation, and I recognize that. And I would have loved to thought that it was their choice, but it wasn't their choice to switch their model. And you know that there was this whole craziness of a back-end multiplier that fell off, and it's a very complicated funding issue, and yet has not been resolved. You and I worked hard. We got it all the way to governor's desk, and the governor vetoed it. It's a whole long story. In any case, my greater concern is really just the fact that there's a lot of haves and have-nots in your runs here. And that was just an example, you know, that there's quite a bit of funding headed to Minneapolis and St. Paul, and much lesser so to some of the other school districts. And, you know, I understand that they've got needs and they've got and all of that. So let me ask it a slightly different way about the money on the base. How much did you put on the base formula so that everyone gets the same base amount?
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative O'Neill, we treat all districts equally in this approach. All districts receive 55 point something percent decrease in their special education deficit. So we took an equality approach to this to every district across the state. right now we are in and have been in a situation where districts across the state are taking on water. There's a hole in the boat. And we can certainly put more fuel in the tank, but if we don't, members, patch that hole in the boat's not going to get very far. And dealing with the funding deficits in special education and English language learning is that we've created, the holes we board in the bottom of those boats is our first responsibility. And that's the approach we've chosen to take.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I appreciate that. And I realize that, you know, even in my school districts, in my district, there are varying amounts of the cross-subsidy. And some districts have really huge cross-subsidies and some have slightly less than the very huge cross-subsidy issues. I totally get that. I understand that. It's just a little bit concerning if we're going to spend $1.1 or so billion in this biennium and over $2 billion in the next biennium, that at least in the runs, it's just such a wide gap, right? And I get it if all you're trying to do is cross-subsidy, but I think there's a little bit more going on in your bill than just cross-subsidy, because the cross-subsidy number is, you know, less than half of the what we're doing this biennium, right? And so there's a lot more going on here. And I just wanted to point out that when you add it all together, you add all these crazy categoricals and you run the formula, that there are haves and have-nots in the runs. And I just wanted to point out that a couple of my schools are in the have-nots, and they're just about half of what Minneapolis-St. Paul is getting. So I appreciate the conversation, and I know you and I have talked about these things in the past, and we tried to help specific situations like Monticello, and unfortunately we did not prevail, even though we gave it a really good go for two biennials, and we still couldn't get their money. So they are in a world of hurt, which is why you keep hearing from them. And honestly, their administration just flat gave up, because we had tried for 4 years to try to get money for them, and they finally just said, look, we just don't have the bandwidth to keep doing this. So I'm sure they're not completely unique in that, but in that sense where they were forced to change their structure, they are. So I appreciate that. I you know, maybe someday we'll see a little surprise and a budget that actually makes them whole. That'd be nice, but I don't see it today. Thank you, Chair Daphne.
Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Daphne, I'm looking at the $422.6 million for the special ed cross-subsidy reduction. I get that. Could you point to us in the bill where there's any special ed reform?
Chair Daphne.
That is called on by school districts every single year.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, one place where we do provide reform is we provide dedicated funding for special education teachers to have more time to provide students the due process paperwork and families the due process paperwork that's required under state and federal law, so that we can be sure that their focus can be more on the teaching, because they've been granted more time outside of the school day to do the necessary paperwork. As you know, the issue around special education is a lot around paperwork. That has continued to be an ongoing conversation. Finding consensus with everyone on that is often challenging, and was not a focus of the Finance Committee this year. I don't know, since I don't serve on the Education Policy Committee, what conversations there were there.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do sit on education policy, and not a lot of time was dedicated towards addressing the actual paperwork issue. So I understand you wanting to give the teachers more time to complete the paperwork, but that issue could be solved by doing something about the paperwork challenges that these teachers have. And there's nothing in this bill that addresses that. Another question, or just another, maybe just a statement, but, you know, the amount of money in this bill when we had last year was a budget year, Now we're adding more money, and I understand you guys have your targets, and the Democrats in the House are spending pretty much all of the surplus over the next few years because this, the spending goes into the tails. But, you know, it seems to me that this is almost, the money in this bill is almost a buy-off for the over 50 mandates that are in this bill, 50 mandates. And we know every time the school districts come to us, and we all get this from our own school districts, please no more mandates. Please no more mandates. And instead of eliminating mandates, this bill adds 50 mandates. And we're going to, it just, it's so frustrating that nothing is being done about that. But we're piling on the mandates, and then, oh, since we piled on the mandates, we're going to give you this money to, I don't know what the motive there is, to keep them satisfied or quiet or whatever. But it's, this is a backward approach to what our educational system needs right now. And Representative Dadney, one final question. Could you address in this bill, you know, over the last few years, we've had, these kids have had a lot of lost learning. So where in this bill, I mean, to me, this bill, if you're going to spend more money, this bill should be full of a policy that gets these kids caught up. So could you point to me in the bill the areas where you're addressing these years of lost learning?
Sure, Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I'd also remind you that we have the Special Ed Tuition Billing Working Group in the bill, which is another area of reform in special education that's been a long an area of challenge. Madam Chair and members, I'd remind you the delayed learning that some students and many students have experienced can be best dealt with dealing with the special education cross-subsidy deficit, the English language learner cross-subsidy deficit, with declining enrollment support for schools, providing schools with stable, secure funding so that they can then work on addressing the needs of students. Some of that delayed learning has been complicated further by challenges to student well-being and mental health. We provide dedicated funding for 1,100 student support personnel across the state to better support students. We also provide funding to help identify education support personnel, classroom aides and such alike, who might want to move into those student support licensed positions to help them get that training and that education and be able to take their places in those schools. So the best thing we can do to help schools deal with delayed learning is to put students at the center of our deliberations, which is what my committee has done and what this bill has expressed.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are there some metrics that we should know about that prove out that these things that you just spoke of will actually produce results?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, as you know, we use the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment, the MCAs, as our primary metric for educational
achievement. But those are optional, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, under federal law, 95% of the students are expected to participate in those tests.
Expected to. Right. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just am very frustrated with this bill and you know, while you say it puts students at the center, I disagree with that. I'll be voting no. That's not a surprise. But thank you for the line of question.
Representative Peterberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for bringing this forward. I'm sure that all districts are appreciative of getting more funding this year as well. And I heard you say at the very beginning that we are paying our bills. And I would disagree slightly in the fact that, in my opinion, no, we're paying the school district's bills. The school districts that have that have taken great pains to be very efficient in how they use those funding, so forth, and others. you know, the way I read the Constitution of Minnesota, it says that the legislature is responsible for the funding mechanisms for the school systems, and the school systems is responsible for the curriculum and educating of the kids within those funding mechanisms. And what we've done over the years is continued the micromanagement of school systems with interventions of mandates and requirements that the legislature has put upon them, at the same time restricting them through very complicated funding mechanisms to do that. And so I don't really see us paying our bills, and instead those that have been more efficient in the use of funding so that their cross subsidies are less than other districts per pupil are actually getting a deficit. And those that have been unwilling to make some of those decisions are being rewarded with additional dollars in here. And so I have some concern about that, and just about the fact that we continue to put on more mandates and requirements on schools without taking into effect all of those mandates. Require additional administration, paperwork, et cetera. It all becomes a net negative as well. Now, I did hear you talk about the boat with the hole in it, and we've got water coming in, and how this bill plugs that hole. Well, in my opinion, what this bill does is actually just increases the pumping, the pumps, to keep the water out of the ship. We really haven't plugged any holes, because the hole really is the overwhelming mandates that schools have to deal with. And if we really wanted to deal with that hole of siphoning off funding, we ought to deal with those mandates. And so I'm hoping that we're not going to change the bill today. It's going to go through the way that you wish it to. But I hope into the future that we have some thought about how we reduce the mandates and allow the school systems and school districts to actually deal with providing the curriculum within the funding that we give them, rather than us always stepping in. So that's kind of just my two cents worth, and I appreciate the work that you've done on this, but I think we have to deal with the mandates, we have to deal with all the other things, giving them the opportunity, giving our school districts the opportunity to actually educate our kids that's best for them. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is Mr. Strom still on?
Mr. Strom, are you present?
Madam Chair, I am still here.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, it's good to see you again. Just a couple of questions from the spreadsheet. First of all, I guess we learn something every day, but line 95 of the spreadsheet shows special education 90-10 shift. It seems to imply that when we paid off the shift, we did not pay off the special education shift. Is that correct? Am I reading that right?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair.
Perhaps Ms. Beckel could address this question.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, Solvay Beckel, House Fiscal. Line 95 of the spreadsheet shows the special education 90-10 shift. This item shows the cost in fiscal year 23 only of shifting special education funding from 87.66% funding in the year of the entitlement, and then the cleanup payment of 12.34% in the following year, to the 90-10 shift that we see in more of the education funding formulas and more of the education funding appropriation.
Madam Chair and Ms. Beckel, so I'm just curious, and I apologize for old habits die hard, so I, of course, run to Mr. Strom when I don't know something. So, Ms. Beckel, on line 95 there, so why was that not already 90-10?
Mrs. Beckel.
Madam Chair, Representative, so I believe at some point in the past this was shifted because there were not funds to pay for the full 90% in a given year. But as I have just started on this policy area, I cannot speak to the history of that. So perhaps you would indeed be better served by Mr. Strom in this instance.
It's okay. Madam Chair, Ms. Beckel, thank you. And I Because usually in law, we automatically pay this stuff back. Like, it automatically goes back to 90-10. So just, and Mr. Strom or Ms. Beckel, I can speak with you offline. I was surprised to see that. For either Mr. Strom or Ms. Beckel, on line four, we have declining enrollment aid of $25 million. Already in state statute, I call them phantom students. We already compensate districts for declining enrollment. We give them money for students they no longer have. How is this $25 million allocated in terms of that declining enrollment? I know we have a, I think it's 77% for existing law. How is this $25 million allocated to school districts then?
Ms. Beckel.
Madam Chair, Representative, if I can pass this one off to Mr. Strom, I'd appreciate that.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, in the one-time declining pupil aid that's in the bill, it's calculated on the fall enrollment numbers, the number of students enrolled on October 1st, essentially, of each site aggregated to the district level. It would include the enrollment in programs like intermediate programs, and it compares the fall 21 enrollment number to the fall 20 enrollment number. The total loss for any district is then proportionately allocated to reach the $25 million. So the districts with the largest percentage decline between the fall of 21 and the fall of 20 will receive the proportionate amount of that $25 million. It's a one-time aid paid 100% in fiscal 23. The regular formula, as you mentioned, the regular declining aid formula that's in general education pays 28% of the formula allowance for each student who's not there in the following year using the measure of adjusted pupil units.
Representative Garofalo.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And then to either of our nonpartisan research, it looks like there's some levy increases, but it looks like they're all bought down by the operating capital equalization. Is that right?
Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, yes, that's correct.
Okay. And then the base special education increase, it used to be that every year we would increase the special education formula automatically by, I believe, 4.9%. Is that still the case for forecast into the future?
Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, the 4.6% annual increase in the base is being phased down. Changes about 3 or 4 years ago began to phase that down so that districts' relative share of their total special education costs would become more even amongst districts. When the change was made to the formula that put the 4.6% in place, there were very different starting places for the district. And so the adjustment, the 4.6% adjustment is still in statute, but it reduces by a little bit each year. So it's becoming a smaller number over time until it reaches a 2% adjustment.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, my final question with regards to that. So with the Dabney bill where the special education cross-subsidy is being eliminated, is that 4.6% increase still going to apply to it regardless of the expenses, or will it be capped at the current limit that we set in law?
Mr. Sherman.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, the 4.6% adjustment happens first, and then the cross-subsidy gets determined. So the more growth there is on the front end of the formula, the less of the cross-subsidy there would be. Alternatively, if there's less growth on the front end of the formula, there'd be slightly more in the cross-subsidy as well. So the cross-subsidy formula comes into play at the very end after all the other calculations of the special education our formula are made. Then the cross-subsidy says of the remaining amount that's not funded, a percentage is funded. And that's the primary line that Representative Dabney's House File 4300 adjusts by pushing that number from 6.43% up to slightly above 55%.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Ms. Beckel and Mr. Strom, thank you for answering those questions. Representative Dabney, I want to wish you happy trails as you retire into your post-legislative activity. I'll save most of my comments for this for the House floor, but I do want to thank you for your work over the last 22 years in the legislature. So, I mean, when you first got elected, you had hair.
It's true.
But, Madam Chair,
no, it's not.
Representative Daffney, so I'll be voting no on your bill today. I do think it's important, as we're talking about this, to look at the specific dollar amounts. For this fiscal year, this bill contains a $1.15 billion increase in spending. In the tails, it's $2.1 billion. Even by the standards we use today, that is an exceptional amount of money. And so I'll be voting no, but Representative Daffney, once again, I want to say well, thank you for your friendship, and I wish you happy trails in your post-legislative activity.
All right. Representative Grecia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Daffney, for your work in the bill, and I've enjoyed working with you the last 4 years, and I'll just get out of the way. I do wish you well as you go on beyond this. So I know, as many of us that sit in the education and all the committees, I know a lot of the conversations and policies that we see come from a place of trying to solve things that are out there, injustices, ills, and frankly, just bad policies. So I respect that. I respect that. So a couple of questions that I have on the bill. The board member section, just walk me through why we're putting that in. Lines 4.15, and we can go to staff too. It's just an understanding. We switched that employment relationship from 8,000 to 20,000. Why are we doing that again?
Chair Daffney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Christian. First, thank you. I've appreciated and enjoyed our partnership the last 4 years as well. So thank you for your kind words. That provision came forward from, if I understand it correctly, the School Boards Association, who were recognizing that some school board members also work part-time in their districts and that there's a value to that. You know, you get to see it from the inside and the outside, from the top and the bottom, but that $8,000 salary limit was artificially low.
Representative Grecia.
Very good. Thank you, and I believe that was to the point of, again, trying to encourage good people to serve on school boards, see the multiple perspectives. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we want this to be an engaging, the school board position to be an engaging position that's helpful. A couple of other questions. Is Mr. Uni still on from MDE?
Chair Daffney.
Madam Chair, Representative Grecia, I'm here.
Okay. Mr. Uni, under the ethnic studies piece, it came from the House File 3434 Fraser bill. Is, to this point, is MDE already working on any of these curriculums or these studies? Is any of that going to be available soon?
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Grecia, what I can tell you in terms of, you know, the department is not authorized under law to create curriculum. We do have the statutory mandate to review and revise our academic standards on a 10-year cycle, and that includes a range of subjects, including one of the ones we just went through, which is social studies standards, and we're in the math standards right now. But to your question specifically around, are we implementing or creating curriculum, and particularly to ethnic studies, we are not in charge of creating curriculum.
Representative Grecia.
Madam Chair, and so Mr. Rooney, so just so I'm clear, so in this part of the bill, we create mandates around that, and we're not the FBI, the CIA, so I'm hoping that this isn't under some secret place where we're doing these clandestine curriculum best practices studies. My question is this, I'll just get right to it. Is MDE working on anything of a framework that could quickly be implemented if this bill was passed to get out to schools?
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Grecia, I'm just trying to look at the exact language in the bill to just kind of see what the timelines are. But what I can tell you is that we are overseeing the process for reviewing and revising the academic standards. In terms of curriculum, that would be up to the school districts and charter schools to be able to access the curriculum with their resources that they feel best fits their communities within the strictures of whatever would ultimately be passed under this bill and what is required to meet the academic standards that are passed under the review and revision process that we engage in under statute. In terms of the timelines of when things are, I'll have to look at the exact line item lines to see what the timelines are there. But again, we are in charge of doing academic standards and not in charge of creating curriculum.
Representative Crecia.
So, Ms. Ernie, I know that MDE has been trying to hire an ethnic studies specialist. Has that position been filled yet?
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Crecia, I believe we are still in the process of hiring. I believe it's been posted and we are looking at candidates. I will have to provide an update to the committee soon. I believe Assistant Commissioner Bobby Burnham had to step away to another meeting, and I can check with her and try to get that information to you.
Thank you.
Representative Crecia.
And Mr. Rooney, I'm not trying to be evasive but it seems to me, in the interest of being fully transparent, that MDE is looking for a position. That position would create guidelines or curriculum to adopt academic standards for ethnic studies in a bill that we don't even know has been passed yet, or if this would survive through the process of conference committees and all that. So what concerns me is that we may have a scenario where MDE has already created some of this and would be asking for expedited rulemaking to push something that has already been vetted or created by a specialist. Are you telling me that scenario doesn't exist in the job description for this position, where they're not going to be creating that type of curriculum that could be very easily, if this were to pass, go into school district as that mandated curriculum?
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Crecia, I want to be absolutely clear.
Yep.
For the committee that the department is not authorized to create curriculum or promote any particular curriculum. We do in certain circumstances and certain subjects provide resources and access on our website or to other organizations that that provide access to curriculum as a resource that is available. We don't promote or push any particular curriculum. We're not or create curriculum. We're not allowed to do that under statute. For the academic specialist who has the responsibilities of helping implement ethnic studies, their responsibility, we had funds that were provided to us in our operating allocation under last year's bill that we put forward for hiring an ethnic studies specialist who will be in charge of helping implement the academic standards. So some of their job responsibilities would include being able to provide guidance and implementation assistance for districts and charters around how to best meet the state academic standards. They would be able to respond to a district's response, and that would include webinars, and that would include trainings and those types of things. And they would be able to respond to district's questions of, hey, does this type of general curriculum meet the academic standards? But they wouldn't specifically be promoting any particular curriculum. They would really be providing technical assistance around implementation. And to your point around would this job position be covering work that isn't already part of law? I would say that under our last academic standards revision cycle, there were several standards and benchmarks that were put into place around, at least at this point, we're in the SONAR process in front of the administrative law, or the SONAR process that will go in front of the administrative law judge soon. But in our current academic standards that are under review, we do have some ethnic studies components. And so those will come within the responsibility of that ethnic study or of that ethnic studies specialist when they come on board and start that work.
So, Member, I just want to quickly say these are like absolutely fantastic questions and information that and learning that we're having here. We have about 10, 11 minutes left, and if we do not finish before 10:45, we will come back this afternoon. Representative Crecia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, no problem.
No pressure.
So, just quickly then. So, thank you for that, Mr. Uni. And so what I'm hearing is, and the concerning part of this is, let's take the human side of this. The Department of Education, like any other organization, is anticipating and looking at how it's going to meet the needs of what it's being asked for. Statutorily, they're not being asked to do this, but they are creating the standards that they're not statutorily being asked to create for those standards. My question quickly would be, Mr. Unu, if this bill were to pass, would that give the Department of Education, in your estimation, the statutory authority to go ahead and put out the curriculum that isn't created but kind of is created?
Mr. Unu.
Madam Chair, committee members, again, I'll just be clear.
And by the way, I like Mr. Unu, just so we're clear.
And it's true. We are friends who push each other. Madam Chair, committee members, Representative Krisha, again, I just have to be clear. The department is not promoting a particular curriculum. In terms of the standards, if the component of this bill that the department put out, which is embedding ethnic studies across our academic standards, as well as making it part of the knowledge and skills portion of our statutes, which comes under compulsory instruction, yes, we would view that as the ability of this ethnic studies specialist to be able to assist districts in meeting the academic standards, which require all of them to have ethnic studies as a component of them. There are provisions in this bill that the department did not put forward that do come from, you correctly identified, Representative Frazier's bill, that include ethnic studies task force, as well as a range of activities that the department would have to engage in to do further implementation of the academic standards. But, pardon me. I will be clear, it wouldn't give us any free rein to implement any type of particular curriculum. We've been clear, I think, with the advocates and Representative Frazier and others that the department is not allowed to implement curriculum. So we would not interpret anything that passed in here as the department being promoting a particular curriculum.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple quick ones just from my understanding, Chair Dabney. We bring forth in this bill the mandate for menstrual products provided, and also we have where school districts cannot, they may not discriminate for ceremonial dress for graduation, which I think are fine provisions. I'm just curious, why did they raise to this level? Has this happened a lot? Do we have a big problem with students not being able to get feminine hygiene products? And do we have schools that have told students they can't wear a ceremonial into the graduation ceremonies? I just don't know. I'm just asking.
Sure, Dan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Krisha, the funding for menstrual products is really an expression of some remarkable leadership from young women, high school women, who have taken up that issue. It's really part of a national trend. Elsewhere, you'll see the same thing. But they have done remarkable work in bringing that issue forward. It's got bipartisan and bicameral support, and I'm proud to carry that provision. As they point out, we provide soap and toilet paper and hand towels in the bathrooms, and we can provide menstrual products as well. To the ceremonial regalia for Native American students, yes. We have school districts that have prohibited Native children from wearing ceremonial regalia at their high school graduation ceremonies, which is obviously a very meaningful, hopefully a very meaningful event in a young student's life.
Representative Creason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I appreciate that, and you know, that's wrong, and that shouldn't have happened. Just a couple of other quick things, just so I keep us respectful of time. But there's no formula increase. And Mr. Strom, if you're still available, I'm just curious. We could have done a formula increase, which would have allowed dollars to flow into general fund, and school districts could have then applied that to the special ed cross subsidy. Is that correct?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair?
Mrs. Strom?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. The choice is the legislature's on which funding formulas to put money on. The rule of thumb that is often used in the K-12 world is that each dollar on the formula allowance costs roughly $1 million. So if you were to take the amount spent on the special education reimbursement or any other line on the spreadsheet. If you were to take $1 million, you could raise the formula allowance by $1. So if you were to take $100 million from a different place and put that on the formula allowance, you could raise the formula allowance by $100.
Representative Christian.
And thank you, Mr. Strom. I have you, but just so I get the affirmation. And that dollar, school districts could have applied that to the cross-subsidy shortfall as well without actually having us to target it this way. Is that correct?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Cresha, yes, the school districts currently pay for their cross-subsidy for special education out of their regular operating funds. Whatever their shortage is in special education comes out of the rest of their budget. And in the same manner, if there were additional general education money for the from the formula, that money would be available to help cover the special education shortfall.
Representative Cresha.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Strom. And before, I don't have any further questions for you, Mr. Strom. I'll just, again, thank you, Ms. Ahrens, and all the other staff. I don't remember all the names as well, but as we all know, staff is absolutely fantastic, and it makes us way more articulate as legislators than we appear to be just because we stay at hotels. So one of the things, my closing remarks on this is I come up, Chair Dabney, and members, what we have is a philosophical difference. Every problem we have in here is tied back to conversations that have come up, doesn't matter who's in charge. And one quick note I'll say is it's absolutely appalling to me that the federal government can't fix the special ed gap that they've created when we quickly got money through COVID. And for years we've been talking about this. And this is a problem that was solvable, but the fortitude and courage from our federal government hasn't been there on this, which is appalling because we're talking about our greatest future resource of kids. But we're left with this scenario, and the scenario that we have is a philosophical difference, where I believe we're skirting the line of trying to be a state school board versus a diverse school boards around the state. This bill gets us in the direction of creating more of a state school board model where we drive mandates and we come down with the 50 mandates. We've got over 800 musts in this bill. And those all give us the indication that this bill is acting like how do we create a state school board situation that drives it down to the schools. And if we're going to do that, then maybe we should just take our local school boards and local control away completely because we're headed that way. We can't have both. I contend that in the areas that I represent and the conversations I have out in rural Minnesota, that more diversity is better. That, I mean, we're doing the school board language here because we do value our school boards. We do value the people that are closest to the students who can make those decisions and have those conversations with the students and work with superintendents. That there's value in that. But we are now taking that decision making and we're moving it to a state level. And instead of actually solving the mandate solving the special ed program and the fallacies that come of there and all the things that happen, we just add more time and add more money. We give teachers more time to work on a problem and a load that's getting higher rather than reducing their load. And I think that that puts the chair in the untenable position of creating a bill that has everything to everybody but doesn't really get us on the path of improvement for many of these areas. I think that when we look at this, it reminds me of an Apple video that many of us may have seen. I think it was in the late 80s where there was a person up on the screen and somebody comes running in from the back and they smash the screen. And it was in 1984. Boy, we're old. But this bill, it worries me because we as a legislature are heading down to a path where we're trying to make everything fit into one box. And that's not what's designed to work the best for our schools. It's not what's designed to solve the cultural and community differences across the state. So, Chair Dabney, I understand where your approach comes from. I think there's a philosophical difference. I think that
what the school districts I've talked to feel like they're being bribed to take a $500 less per pupil on this with no formula increase just to take the mandates that are going to come. And I know where those mandates have all come from. They've come from a fear that we're going to do something or something's going to happen in the past. I mean, we elevate menstrual products over meals for kids that didn't make it into this bill. And so while, you know, I see all of these things, I see the incongruencies of what we created and the scenario where a one-size-fits-all school board type of approach at the state level is becoming more appealing in this bill than if we were to push that to local decision-making for our schools. I'll be voting no.
Seeing no further discussion, Chair Dabney, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief given the time. I first want to thank the staff, both partisan and nonpartisan. Every kind thing that Representative Kreisha just said about staff and their role is true, and I emphasize that as well. It was excellent to be able to phone some friends here, and I really like having the little screen right here where I can track from this position. And you're right, Madam Chair, the questions in the discussion were absolutely fantastic, and I appreciate it. There's a lot that I could respond to, but I will say this. I think the philosophical difference is whether we take on the responsibility that we've taken on or not. We have mandated certain services. Every child in Minnesota should have the opportunity for a world-class education. We should not look at reducing services for some kids because they're more expensive or more inconvenient to educate. We mandate those services because they're the right thing to do, because they create opportunity, and they create an opportunity for Minnesota. It's our responsibility to pay the bills. The philosophical divide here is whether we should stand up to our responsibility or not. Madam Chair, members, thank you for the discussion. Thank you for the questions. I ask for your support on House File 4300 as amended.
Well, thank you, Chair Dabney. You know, the last 2 years have been a real challenge for everyone from this associated with our educational system, from our children to our parents to our educator. We are in a historical moment in time where we have underfunded education. We have some of the worst disparities in the country right here in our educational system. And so this is our moment where, as we have a surplus, to do the real investment, to make sure, as you stated, Chair Dabney, that every child has the opportunity to succeed and be successful in school and thus in life. So I just want to thank you for your work and the committee work that you've done this session to really step up to the plate to make sure that we're taking this time when we can. Over the last 2 years, it has been so tough for so many to create a pathway that's going to be fair and equitable for our children within the educational system. And I think this bill will address some of those really critical needs that we need to be addressing today. So, there being no further discussion, we will proceed to the motion to combine these two bills and send them to the floor using House File 4300 as the vehicle. Vice Chair Olson, would you like to move that language contained in House File 4300 as amended to be incorporated into the education omnibus as separate articles?
So moved, Madam Chair.
So the Olson motion is before us. To be clear, this is just one of the motions to include the education bill as separate articles into the omnibus education bill. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. Chair Pinto, your bill spans two different areas. For today, would you like to move that Article 5 and 6 contained in House File 4735 as amended be incorporated into the education omnibus as separate articles?
So moved, Madam Chair.
So the Pinto motion is before us. This vote is to incorporate just Article 5 and 6 from House File 4735 into the Omnibus Education Bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. So members, we now have the House File 4300 as amended before us. The next vote will be the final vote on the combined package. Vice Chair Olson renews her original motion that House File 4300 as amended be recommended for placement on the general register, and that nonpartisan staff be directed to make any technical corrections and amend the title. This would be a roll call vote. Ms. Anna. Please take the roll.
Chair Moran?
Aye.
Chair Moran, aye. Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo?
Garofalo, no.
Garofalo, no. Representative Albright?
No.
Albright, no. Representative Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan?
Hassan, aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas?
Hertas, no.
Hertas, no. Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Johnson, no. Representative Kreshaw?
Kreshaw, no.
Kreshaw, no. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly?
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani?
Mariani, aye.
Mariani, aye. Representative Marquardt?
Aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller?
No.
Miller, no. Representative Nash? Oh, Nash, excuse. Sorry, excuse me. Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative O'Neill?
No.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski, aye. Representative Petersburg?
No.
Petersburg, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Schultz?
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott?
No.
Scott, no. And Representative Sundin?
Sundin, aye.
Sundin, aye. Madam Chair, that is 18 ayes and 10 nays.
There have been 18 ayes and 10 nays. The motion prevails. House File 4300, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register, and nonpartisan staff are directed to make any and all technical corrections and amend the title. I want to say thanks to all the chairs and your committee for putting together this important work. Members, that completes our work for today. Thank you all for your attention to this week. Remember, we have no hearing tomorrow. And I hope that you all have a great weekend. And again, put everything away that you need to put away. And this committee hearing is adjourned. Thank you.